dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I've come to admire enormously the clarity of vision, the articulateness, and the factual command of the material that is involved in arguably the single most important battlefront in that war for the free world, namely the one that is increasingly becoming, well, threatening doesn't begin to describe it, involving communist China. He is, of course, Gordon Chang. He is a featured regular on this program, the author of three terrific books about the coming collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. You see him almost constantly at Fox News and publishing in various outlets, National Interest and many others. He is very gracious with his time, and we're always appreciative of him doing so. Gordon, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Frank, and I really appreciate being on your air.
Thank you. We have, of course, had another set of demonstrations over this past weekend, Gordon. One of the things that seems to have had a uptick in popularity, shall we say, is the protesters have been brandishing increasing numbers of American flags. I hear tale that some of them even broke out in the Star-Spangled Banner. What's up with that? And what should it suggest is important for us to be thinking and doing at this moment?
Yesterday, protesters in Hong Kong marched with thousands of American flags to the U.S. consulate, which is in Central. And what they're doing is asking for help from the U.S. Most people there believe that the U.S. should change its policy towards Hong Kong, probably should eliminate the exemptions for Hong Kong. Hong Kong was granted autonomy for 50 years under the One Country, Two Systems formula. We're 22 years into that, and Beijing has been encroaching on that economy. And the reason for the exemptions, which are from sanctions on China, no longer apply because Beijing is effectively running Hong Kong directly. Protesters believe that the way the United States can help them is to weaken communist China, and that's what they're looking for. So they want our help. They need our help. And Frank, we need their help because they are the front line of freedom these days.
Amen. You know, one other sign that I was told appeared in the mix in the course of, I guess, these demonstrations this weekend was one that said, Communist China owes the United States $1 trillion, which I think is a reference to sovereign debt, that there's now an increasing awareness needs to be settled in the process of all of this to-ing and fro-ing on trade and so many other issues, Gordon. So we'll be watching this space. But talk about the economy of China at the moment. The evidence seems to be accumulating that it is, well, if not tanking, certainly very dramatically slowing down, something you wouldn't know, of course, from the official statistics.
Yeah, even from official statistics, Frank, we're getting a picture that there may be no growth at all in China. And this was highlighted by the release about 48 hours or so ago of the trade numbers for China for August. Exports were unexpectedly down 1.0%, and imports were down 5.6%. The more important number is the import one, because that shows domestic demand. And imports in China have been down now for four straight months. That indicates that there is weakness throughout the Chinese economy. And that's an indication of two things. First of all, Xi Jinping's policies of state domination, getting rid of the foreign companies and the private sector, that's not working. But also there's President Trump's tariffs, and those seem to be having an effect on top of what Xi Jinping is doing on his own. Protesters in Hong Kong, I think, by and large, believe that President Trump's tariffs are good, that they should be increased because they will weaken China. And so this is primarily an economic struggle first, because if the Chinese economy fails, and there's a large chance of that occurring, let's say within the next year or so, then China will not have the ability to challenge the United States across the board. But also, Frank, if it fails, Beijing may lash out before then. And so we've got to be on our guard, especially now, because I think China is more dangerous than it's been in many, many decades.
Right. Well, the cumulative effect of much that we have done over those decades to build them up. And Gordon, I did just want to ask before we turn to one of the ways in which we're building them up that's particularly worrying as we speak. It's been, I thought, a long-time premise of China watchers that if they didn't enjoy, well, some would say double-digit growth, at least pretty robust growth, 7, 8, 9%, that was going to be extremely perilous for the regime, which is already buffeted by a lot of internal dissent, not just in Hong Kong, but in the mainland as well. Your thoughts?
Yeah. People used to say double-digit growth, and then people started to say, well, 8% growth as it slipped below 10. China claimed a growth of 6.3% in the first half of this year, but we're starting to see an economy that really does not look like it's growing at all. China's had two good months this year, March and July, so they were able to do that, but they were only able to do that by piling on the debt. And analysts say that China's creating 6.7 times the more debt than it is gross domestic product. And that they can do for a little while, but not for too much longer.
Yeah. And presumably they can't sustain this massive expenditure program that they've engaged in around the world, mostly with countries that are unlikely to be able to repay the debt that they're going to try to charge them. So this is brings us to the last point in this short segment with you, Gordon Chang. On Thursday, our Committee on the Present Danger, China, is going to be holding a briefing, we call them a threat briefing, on one of the ways in which we are providing life support to communist China, despite, you know, President Trump's efforts to turn the screws and the like. And that would be through the investments that Wall Street is making, mostly through something called the MSCI, a Morgan Stanley product, global index, that allows Chinese companies, increasingly Chinese companies, to gain access to American investors' monies and that of others. Gordon, what's particularly worrying is that according to a decision that was taken several years ago, the Thrift Review Board, I believe it's called, that oversees the thrift savings plan of the federal retirement system, is about to mirror those investment decisions of the MSCI, which would mean perhaps as much as $500 billion worth of federal government employees' monies would be, pension funds would be invested in some of these companies. Very quickly, how do you see that as a strategic matter as well as an economic one?
Well, Frank, this obviously is strategic because China does need money. And this is something that President Trump can stop. He does have the power by emergency order, probably under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, but also probably through other legislation as well.
Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that for today. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll talk with you again next week.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, and really proud to say, joined by a man I've admired and worked closely with for many years, mostly after he left a distinguished 35-year-long career in the United States Air Force. He graduated from West Point and went into the Air Force to become a pilot and served with great distinction, rising to the rank of Lieutenant General, commanding along the way the Alaska Air Command and finishing up his tour as the Assistant Vice Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force. He is, of course, Lieutenant General Thomas McInerney, United States Air Force, retired. He is these days the chairman of Yotta Store, LLC, which is a cloud-based storage company that provides services to the federal government in the classified domain and to other customers. A great American, through and through, and a man who I was privileged to join in co-signing an open letter to the president concerning what to do about Afghanistan to try to ensure that we have a secure Afghanistan, not once again a Taliban and jihadist-dominated one. Tom McInerney, it's so good to have you with us, sir. Thank you for your extraordinary leadership on this and so many other issues. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Great to be with you, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Well, Tom, you have been very strongly supportive of the president, as have I, over a long period of time. And I think this effort is an effort to, well, very much continue that, supporting him. I'd like to talk a little bit about why it seems we need a reboot on our approach to the Afghan problem.
Well, I think we both agree, and many of us do, that 18 years is long enough in Afghanistan, and it cannot go on into perpetuity. So the fact is what the president is trying to do is the right model. We are just touching up on it and saying that we believe the danger of getting together in a partnership with the Taliban, that will fail because they have that evil ideology of radical Islam that has permeated the world in the last 20 plus years in such a dangerous position when they expanded and attacked the United States in 9/11. We cannot let that ideology that the Taliban, that ISIS, that they are, the radical Islamists have. And so it's important that we contain it. We have not had major attacks in the United States since then. And so I think the proposal of the special operations model and accords model, we'll talk about both, is extremely important, and your leadership has been invaluable in this area, Frank.
Well, thank you, Tom. This is a project that, of course, is taking place against the backdrop of, as you say, an initiative by the president. I think the world was shocked to learn over the weekend that not only was he engaged, of course, through the efforts of Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad in direct negotiations with the Taliban, but that he envisioned having them come to Camp David this past weekend. That was aborted after the most recent of these myriad attacks by the Taliban against American forces. But General McInerney, when you talk about the president's initiative, you're speaking specifically of his effort to draw down the number of Americans involved in Afghanistan, but maintain a presence. And just talk a little bit about the kind of recommendations. We'll be speaking shortly with a man who was deeply involved in the CORDS program, Steve Young. But you also had experience with it during your four tours in Vietnam. And I'd like to sort of have you sort of summarize what this Secure Afghanistan proposal basically suggests in outline form.
Well, let's quickly talk about the special operations model, which we are taking highly skilled civilians that have had experience over there, former military people, and we are going to insert them using air power and the intelligence capabilities and logistics capabilities that we have and insert them into the country to leave, if we left, say, approximately 2,000 U.S. military there. And so by putting this civilianized national security force in Afghanistan, we could beef up and continue the efforts to make the Afghan military self-sustaining. And then at the same time, we would have what we call a CORDS model, which CORDS is C-O-R-D-S. It's the Civil Operations and Rural Development Support Program that was so successful during the Vietnamization strategy. Now, people are going to say, well, that failed. No, it didn't fail. CORDS didn't fail. And the Vietnamization strategy didn't fail. What failed was the Democratic Congress
that cut off all the funding when the North Vietnamese directly attacked South. Now, we'll not go back and redefine that war, but the model of the civil operations and rural development support, in other words, building up the communities out there in the far-off countryside that has never been unified in Afghanistan, strengthening that, strengthening the economics, and doing those things that give a coherency for the Afghan people to grow economically, to grow socially. Again, I point out that unless these two things, you have the tip of the spear, if you will, on the special forces model of supporting the Afghan government, the military, and then you have the civil side of building up it's fundamentally nation building, if you will, that we can do there, but it's got to be them doing it. But you have this group of core people that will help in that civil operations and rural development support, build them up economically, build them up socially, all those things. That's very important.
Let me just tease out some of these things. And again, we'll be discussing at greater length the CORDS program. But the idea of getting these veterans now out of the uniform of the United States, but the idea would be to have them in uniform, I think, of the Afghan uniform, fighting alongside the troops on the ground of the Afghan security forces and helping them with air power and helping them with intelligence support, the kinds of things that would enable people who want to fight and protect their country against the kind of horror that you've so aptly described, sir, the I call it Sharia supremacist ideology that devastated that country in the past, particularly women in that country, but it wasn't so good for everybody else either. That is a very important alternative approach to the one that we have been pursuing thus far, which has been primarily U.S. boots on the ground, doing much of the fighting, sometimes alongside, but often not as closely alongside as one would like, those Afghan units. And General McInerney, based upon your experience, both in Vietnam and, of course, in subsequent conflicts, does this seem as though it's a means by which we could certainly reduce the size of the U.S. presence and the cost of supporting this effort, and yet still have the fight taken to the enemy in a way that might, well, as we say, secure Afghanistan?
Yes, it does, Frank. I like it very much. The additional thing I would say, we need to get the Arabs to help fund this. They are the ones that are bearing the brunt of this radical ideology that's as evil as Nazism and communism and fascism. And so they should bear the financial burden. And probably we should look at integrating Arab forces into this group that we absolutely need to give Afghanistan the strength that they're going to need to survive this. I would also look at strongly getting the Indians involved. Now, this is going to cause a problem with Pakistan. But Pakistan is the reason this Taliban who survived for 18 years.
Yeah, there is a problem with Pakistan, in other words, already.
They have been the sanctuary for the Taliban. They have been the funding for the Taliban. They have been training people for the Taliban. And so we must hold them accountable and get our other Arab nations to also be supporting us in ways financially and, I believe, consider selected manpower billets, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And, General, when you talk about Pakistan, there are a number of things. This is a very short open letter to the president that we signed out today. General Jerry Boykin was one of the other signatories, and Steve Young, as I say, we'll be speaking with Steve momentarily. But this is intended to be sort of an outline for a new approach. There are important details that have to be sorted out that would involve, for example, you know, the duration of this sort of transitional arrangement. And, you know, the command mechanisms that would oversee these forces in country, and not least, you know, the regional problems that have dogged us all these years, and what could we do to have these things come out differently than they have. But it's a starting point at a moment when, thanks to the president's decision to suspend these talks, it seems there really is a need for some creative thinking about an alternative approach. And I just wanted to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for your leadership in helping to articulate this alternative approach, to lay it out, at least in outline form, and hopefully begin a serious conversation, both internal to the U.S. government, the Trump administration, and of course with the American people. And if we do, I think we may have the opportunity to secure Afghanistan and secure our vital interests there as well. General McInerney, we have to let you go. I appreciate your time so much today, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, sir. Next up, Steve Young, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by another of the signatories on this proposal to President Trump to reboot the Afghanistan effort in a very different way than that we have pursued to this point. We talked with General Tom McInerney before the break about primarily the military or kinetic piece of it, how we could do that differently without this huge American footprint and all that goes along with it in terms of exposing our personnel to harm as well as huge costs. And we're turning now to a man who served with great distinction in Vietnam as one of the managers of the project that is the second part of this proposal to President Trump. It was best known perhaps by its acronym CORDS, which stood for Civil Operations Rural Development Support. And the man who managed was the chief of the village development branch of CORDS in South Vietnam is our guest, Stephen Young. He's no stranger to this program. We've talked with him on a number of occasions, including recently. These days, Steve is the global executive director of the Co-Roundtable on Moral Capitalism. He formerly served as an assistant dean at the Harvard Law School and then as the dean of the Hamline University Law School in Minnesota. A remarkable intellect and great resource, both with respect to his corporate memory and his recommendations about what we need to be doing now to secure Afghanistan. Steve Young, thank you again for joining this effort to help the president take advantage of the opportunity that, well, we now have to think creatively about a different approach to Afghanistan and avoid a surrender to the Taliban, which I fear was in prospect otherwise. Welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. And Frank, let me start off by thanking you for being open to, one, the necessity to persevere, and two, to ideas about how to do it better. One of my frustrations over the last 19 years is you go forward with, I think, the only insurgency the United States has ever defeated in modern times, which was the CORDS program in Vietnam, to senior civilians and senior military people, and they just give you blank stares, kind of like deer in the headlights in Minnesota. And here we are 19 years later, and we couldn't win. We couldn't win with their formula. We probably ought to have a better formula.
Yeah, we ought to look afresh at one that worked. But Tom McInerney spoke about this, and maybe this is where we could start in our deep dive on the CORDS' relevance to the Afghan situation, Steve. And that is, he mentioned that, you know, some people, probably the people looking at you blankly, say, well, we lost Vietnam. What do you mean this was a success? Tell us about why you would argue it was a success and why we nonetheless wound up losing that war to the determined efforts of the North Vietnamese and their friends.
Well, the first point, Frank, which is relevant to today, is the newspaper coverage, the media coverage, and the coverage by our intellectuals at home of the war None of them paid any attention to courts and villages. None of them, I think, spoke Vietnamese. They didn't really understand the Vietnamese people. And the war was in and around and about the people. So it's no wonder that our people back home were never told in great detail about our success. So two quick data points. In early 1973, when the Paris Peace Accord was negotiated by Kissinger and rammed down the throats of the South Vietnamese, the autonomous Viet Cong units, the quote-unquote guerrilla enemy, were carried on the order of battle at 25,000 men. At the same time, the South Vietnamese government, the nationalists, had mobilized over 700,000 South Vietnamese into the military at various levels. And they had another million South Vietnamese in the local village self-defense corps.
Which was one of the products of the Accord's effort, was it not?
Yeah. So if you take as a measure of winning or losing a guerrilla war, who's on your side and who's on the enemy side, we won, right? The communist forces in 73 were Maso Manus, 270,000, 300,000 North Vietnamese regulars who had invaded South Vietnam illegally. The second point is all the public surveys, public opinion surveys we used to do were showing that the number of South Vietnamese who supported the Viet Cong, you know, under 5% at that point, this is in 72, 73. So then you ask, well, what happened? Well, what happened was the Paris peace negotiations and a deal cut by Henry Kissinger with South Vietnam's enemy, the communist North.
Yeah. Hold the thought just for one second, because, Steve, I want to, you know, give our listeners a basis for calibrating what you're about to tell us in all of this, because it is a sordid and shocking story, the more so because of its relevance to what has been happening, I believe, today. But you have had access to the secret, formerly secret, now declassified cables that then Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker was sending and receiving during this period of time. You helped him with his memoirs, now posthumously, but that is an important factual basis for this, as I say, shocking story you're about to share with us. But proceed.
Yes. No, so Kissinger in, I think, late April 71, we're talking 71. We're not talking, you know, the election of 72 after the North Vietnamese invasion. We're talking early, when basically Cords was gaining ground every week, every month, right? So Kissinger asked Bunker for recommendations for terms for negotiations with Hanoi. Bunker comes up with a very, very well thought out plan, most of which Kissinger kept, the key point of which he abandoned. So Bunker has in there the requirement that as U.S. forces leave, or after U.S. forces leave, all North Vietnamese forces will leave South Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. So on May 25, 1971, Kissinger sends a kind of oddly indirectly worded cable back to Bunker and says, oh, by the way, on your point about withdrawals, we will say only that the Indo-Chinese parties will discuss this among themselves, which is the way the final treaty turned out in 72, 73, which means the Americans would no longer insist that the North Vietnamese take their troops out.
But just a data point here, the U.S. would have withdrawn all of its troops. This was not going to be a parallel drawdown or any obligation on the North Vietnamese to be, you know, extricating from South Vietnam at all, right?
Exactly, exactly. Bunker's point was, we're getting out, but if you want a deal, Bunker's point was, if you want a deal to help your folks think about Afghanistan today, which is sort of the Taliban, okay? So if North Hanoi, if you want a deal to help your followers in South Vietnam, we'll give you a deal, right? We'll allow them to have a political party and do that and join the elect, but you have to take your troops out. So Kissinger drops that, and Bunker didn't see it. And it was a longer story, Frank. When I brought this to Bunker's attention, he was very uncomfortable because he had missed it. Because he trusted Kissinger, and Kissinger had wrapped himself in authorization from Nixon. So another quick point is I later got to know Nixon. And finally, after I'd established a friendship, I asked him, I said, Mr. President, do you remember, you know, ever authorizing this? And he had no answer. He looked shocked. He looked absolutely shocked.
Yeah. it's the old, aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, how'd you like the play problem? You know, it's a really big problem that you're overlooking.
Yeah, there's another link to Afghanistan, I think, which is when, after the American forces and bombers, everything left in early 73, he had 700,000 troops, but he had to basically position them to defend every part of a long, narrow South Vietnam. So the defense line was very thin. Hanoi, as it did in 75, you take several of your divisions and you concentrate them against a couple of South Vietnamese battalions. And there's no chance.
Right. And this brings us to the question, though. You had helped build, Steve Young, a civil defense force. You described it as quite large as a result of the success of the CORDS program. They were not able to withstand the onslaught from the North Vietnamese once they punched through, you know, the regular South Vietnamese forces?
Well, this is, I mean, consider again, I wish the audience would keep in mind what they know about Afghanistan today. So what is a civil defense force? You know, it's 30 guys, some young men, the middle-aged men are all off in the army, and some old guys and some women with M2 carbines, you know, left over from World War II, right? And a few other things. And they're patrolling their villages. Now, they can defend the villages against a Viet Cong squad, 10, 15 people, right? How are they going to send off a North Vietnamese company, you know, let's say 100, 150 NVA with AK-47s, you know, major machine guns, B-47 rocket launchers? You can't do it. And so what happens is take a rural village in Afghanistan where they don't even have any self-defense groups, as I understand it. And five Taliban show up some night, or maybe after we're gone, they showed up in broad daylight. They order a meeting of the villagers, right? They order a meeting of the villagers. They call out some senior elder. They accuse him of collaboration with the Americans, and they shoot him on the spot. What are the other people going to do? They're going to fight back?
Let me ask you this, Steve, because I think in addition to, you know, the disparity in firepower and training and discipline of regulars or you know, proficient guerrilla operatives like the Taliban in Afghanistan today versus your ordinary villagers, it can't be overstated the importance of the impact on the morale of those villagers that they seem to be being sold out by the United States. We, again, saw that in Vietnam, and this is kind of the backdrop to what I fear was poised to happen in Afghanistan as well. And Steve, we're going to come back to that point because it's really the context in which you and Generals Boykin and McInerney and I put forward, in the briefest of forms, to be sure, an outline for this alternative approach that would have a key improvement, I think, in the actual fighting force of the Afghan government. We'll be back to talk more with Steve Young right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We have a second installment, I'm happy to say, with our friend Steve Young. He is these days the Global Executive Director of the Co-Roundtable on Moral Capitalism. But he is also a man with long experience, firsthand experience, both in the field and in a management role, with something that was called the Civil Operations and Rural Development Support, or CORDS, initiative in Vietnam. And we've talked with Tom McInerney and now with Steve about the success of CORDS in Vietnam and the need for such a capability in the villages of Afghanistan and towns and hamlets and so on to help backstop what the security forces could do and how this fits together in part of a new sort of rebooted strategy for a secure Afghanistan that he and the generals and I have recommended. So, Steve, you were just making this point, if you can, about how important it is to people, particularly you know, regular folks, peasants in some cases, that they feel as though they're being supported, that it's worth putting their lives on the line, that they're, in short, not being abandoned. Talk about that in the context of Vietnam, and then we'll look ahead to what's been going on now.
Right. I think, Frank, I mean, the context was dramatic in 75 in Vietnam, particularly among the top leadership, but all the way down to local people. When they had figured out the critical turning point, the North Vietnamese, at the orders of their boss, Lê Duẩn, did a test attack, kind of like the Taliban are doing today, right? So they marshaled a whole bunch of forces. They attacked a very isolated provincial town called Phuc Lam to see if the Americans would come back. So they have all their forces. The South Vietnamese are outgunned, outnumbered. They have to run away. And President Ford does nothing. So Lê Duẩn then says, the Americans are out, go for broke. So once after that, about a month later, when Thieu and all the generals and all the people of South Vietnam realized there are going to be no B-52s to stave off the North Vietnamese regulars, you ask yourself, why should I fight in a lost cause? So people just, the morale collapsed within about 3 weeks. If the Taliban get recognized as with the name of a new government of Afghanistan, the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, what are they going to tell all the people across the countryside, especially the Pashtun people, right? They're going to say, we told you so 20 years ago. We told you that Allah was on our side, the Americans would fail, they'd give up, and we would come back to rule the country. Now our day is coming. And we have people, we've got people in your family who are located, you know, who are with us, and we're going to know whether you stand with Allah or whether you stand with the heathens. And well, how do you think the people are going to respond? This is speaking in the language of the ordinary people, that power, real power, is with the Taliban, not with some Afghan military unit, which is 5 miles away.
Right. And may not get there in time to be of any help to them, even if it has the wherewithal to be helpful. So we have watched, I think some of us with great trepidation, I must say, President Trump's ambassador to these talks with the Taliban in Qatar, pursuing a deal that, frankly, in important respects, and I was very pleased to see the Wall Street Journal today editorialized on this point. We've been talking about it for some time, that this looked a lot like the peace talks, secret peace talks that Kissinger was operating, as you described earlier, Steve, only with an ideological foe that arguably is even more determined than were the communists in their day to achieve the submission of all of the non-Muslim world, all of the non-Sharia adherent Muslims, for that matter, as well. And it's compounded by the fact that we know they are joined in that enterprise. They have their differences, but it's kind of like mafia chieftains fighting. But they're all on board with this general proposition that Sharia must triumph, whether it's Al-Qaeda or whether it's the Islamic State or whether it's the Pakistanis that are supporting all of them and the rest. So when you look at the history here and you look at the present and the, you know, through the crystal ball, if you can, the future, how vital is it that we have this sort of combined sense that we're still engaged, though primarily through these forces that we will be providing from veterans and contractor personnel to help support the kinetic part of the fight with the Afghan forces, and this civil defense and other rural development support work that it would be modeled after the CORDS program to having a chance of this coming out right in Afghanistan?
Of course you have a chance, because the Taliban are a very, very small number of Afghans, and most of them are Pashtun. So you're really dealing with an intertribal rivalry here. So what you have to do is you have to give the mass of the Pashtuns a sense that this is our fight. And what we have done by coming in top down, top heavy, even though we tried to internationalize it with other Europeans, we've allowed the Taliban to have the upper side, the upper hand in the ideological struggle, where they say, these are foreigners, these are heathen, these are not our people.
Infidels.
They are infidels. We represent the best of our religion and our people. You have to pop that balloon. And the only real way we've learned how to do it is you let the people say, no, sorry, guys, you're wrong. You're just out for yourself. We are defending our families, our land, our tradition, et cetera, et cetera. So at the village level, you couple defense and military security with intelligence, reporting on who are the actual Taliban. And then thirdly, with economic development, little microcredit programs, little grant programs for a village government. And by the way, in Afghanistan today, done, I understand, really without any support from the Americans, military or civilian, by nonprofits, are community development councils, CDCs, many of them really organized by women to do sort of development work.
Micro-lending and that sort of thing.
Micro-lending, sowing groups, growing new kinds of vegetables, all kinds of little stuff. But this is the first time it taps into a deep and powerful social power, which is the mothers. Every Taliban soldier has a mother, right? And if the mother sort of says, wait a moment, son, this is, you know, you don't really get it all right here. So by turning the focus of the purpose of the effort on our village, our family, our traditions, you mobilize the local people. Now, Frank, there's another point, which even General Petraeus in his coin doctrine, I think I didn't see it in there, which is to go back to Mao Zedong's theory of how to win an insurgency. He has this famous phrase, the guerrillas are the fish that swim in the sea of the people. And his point is that the government can never catch enough of the fish. They'll never catch them all. The war will go on and on and on as fish breed new fish, and they're all protected by the sea of the people. In order to defeat an insurgency, you got to dry up the sea. And that means you got to turn the people against the insurgents.
Right. This is such an important insight, Steve Young. And I think combined with some of the work that you've been doing on, as you call it, moral capitalism and this economic development, you give people a stake in a different kind of outcome than living in the 7th century. With women enslaved at best, and at worst, horrifically tortured and murdered as part of the state operations of this so-called Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. And I have to say that the insults that the Taliban have been meting out to us in the process of these negotiations, one of which is their insistence that we call them the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, as well as that we have nothing to do in terms of actual negotiating partners with the elected government of Afghanistan, or for that matter, the whole issue of, the fact that they're continuing to kill us, even as we're negotiating with them. All of this was clearly calculated, was it not, to show the world, not just the people of Afghanistan, but the world, those jihadists across the world and other enemies of this country, that they were defeating us. They were not simply securing some kind of agreement with us.
Yeah, I think, but my gut feeling is, and I've not been that guy, I just study it from afar, is that the reason for the continued terrorism and the suicide bombers by the Taliban now is looking at the domestic audience, trying to destroy the morale of everybody in Afghanistan. Every time the Taliban strikes in the center of Kabul, right? They're basically sending a signal, God is on our side, we're going to win.
Thank you, my friend, for your good work. Come back to us again soon, and I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.